Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, here we are. Let's get going. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Kelly in Orange County, California. Or rather, Orange, California. Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning. I'm calling because my daughter-in-law, who was raised Baptist by her mother, and they follow Christ, her mother has been in two marriages, divorced, and has no support from former husbands. And she's basically wasted money through her whole life. And now at age 65, she's kind of she's thinking about buying a van and moving to live in it. And she's in another state from my daughter-in-law. But my daughter-in-law wonders, what is her moral obligation to her mother's support? Her mother has other children.
Mm-hmm. Under the commandment to honor your father and mother? Is that what she's thinking of?
Yes. Yes.
Well, there's no strict specific requirement. If her mother needs financial support and she's not squandering the money, you know, let's say that somebody's taking drugs and using money to buy drugs or to do other things that would be wrong, she's under no obligation to fund that. If her mother genuinely needed assistance to stay alive, to stay afloat, and she was in a position to help, even if it's modest help, I think that would fall under the commandment of honoring your father and mother. Jesus, well, in fact... go ahead.
She has a lot of debt herself, and they're just barely starting out.
No, I understand. In other words, you're saying, is it fair for your daughter-in-law to give money to her mother who is leading an erratic life? And I understand the point you're making. I'm just saying, as a way to evaluate it, let's lay out a few principles. So Jesus, in Matthew chapter 15, he condemns the scribes and Pharisees for creating this scheme called the Korban rule, where you could avoid having to help your parents financially by dedicating your money to the temple, so that when they asked you for assistance, you could say no, because I don't have any money. But the legal fiction here was that you really did have complete use of your money. It was just a ruse. It was a trick. So you could technically say you don't have any money because it was dedicated to the temple, but you really did. So I offer that simply as a baseline, to say that if there's a genuine need and the child has some way, the son or daughter, has some way of assisting, if it's possible, and if it's not being squandered like with drugs or something else, there is a built-in obligation. But in this case, she and her husband are just starting out. They don't have any money. The mother-in-law, well, it'd be the other mother-in-law, I think you said she's got a lot of debt. She sounds like she's got a bit of an odd situation where she wants to live in a truck, did you say? She wants to buy a truck and live in that?
Something. She's not able to afford her rent now.
Okay. Yeah, so it sounds like she's in an unstable and chaotic situation. So I would say, rule of thumb, if your daughter-in-law sees, and your son, because his money too, sees that there's a way that they can be of some kind of assistance to her, even though they don't agree with her, you know, whatever, if she's not squandering the money and she really does need some kind of help, if they helped her, that would be, it seems to me, that would be a good thing. Now,
well, she just always does squander money and has always squandered money.
Well, that's why I just said, if she's not squandering the money, it would be a good thing to do. But if she is squandering the money, ergo, it wouldn't be a good thing to do.
Gotcha.
So, you know, the baseline, I guess, is what I was trying to say, is that if you if you know what, you know, what would be considered reasonable, appropriate, helpful. And when something makes it unreasonable or inappropriate or unhelpful, then they would have, you know, they could say with a clear conscience, okay, well, in this situation, it's not helpful for us to give her money because she's going to blow it on gambling or she's going to squander it somehow, you know, because if she really needed the money and she was, what's the word I want here? She was,
destitute.
No, what I mean to say is that if she really needs the money and she's, responsible with it, she would be buying food or she would be paying down debt or something like that. But if she's irresponsible with it and it's not going toward those things that are really important, then they would be, it seems to me anyway, I mean, I can't read anyone's soul, but it seems like you would have a clear case to say, well, under these circumstances, it's not appropriate for us to give her money. Now, one way around this would be they could say, all right, Mom, we'll take over one of your bills. So you have, you know, an electric bill or a cell phone bill, or you have a life insurance policy or something, and we can pay for that where you pay directly to the company that supplies that service. That's another way, because then she can't squander that.
Are they obligated to have her move in with them?
No, they're not obligated. It could be one solution to how they could fulfill this commandment. It could be something that in their heart of hearts, they say, well, this is something that if we do this to help her, it'll get her off the streets or get her out of a bad situation. And I could see some moral weight saying that would be the thing to do. But they're not. There's no set obligation. There's no set amount of money. The church doesn't say you have to take your parents in. It's going to be on a case-by-case basis. And you know, with the emphasis on how do I do the right thing and how do I help even if it involves some suffering? Because sometimes it does.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, I see your point.
Yeah. And I know these are taxing, vexing situations. And, you know, Nancy and I have been in that situation before where someone in the family needs help and the only way to help them is to have them come live with us. It's not ideal, but we've done that any number of times. And it's not our first choice, but sometimes that's the best choice.
Yeah. Yeah. That's saying something with the number of kids you have.
Well, I guess the upside is that we had to have a big house to have all those kids. And so that means we've got space available when people need help.
Gotcha.
Well, thanks,
Kelly. Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I hope things work out in a happy way. Let's go to Bill now in Boston. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Patrick, I'm a devout Catholic. I mean devout. Okay. I listen to radio programs all day pertaining to my faith. But one thing that deters me, it deters me greatly, that when we talk about abortion, okay, it's always the left that gets the fall while the right seems to, the radios, the people that are talking favor the right side because of their no abortion policy. Now, I'm not right, I'm not left.
Okay.
But I don't like to be judged because I don't favor abortion, but I will accept it in conditions that warrant it. And I just feel bad about that we or that people are judged politically wrong if you're on the left side because you believe in a woman's right to do with her body with what she wants. After, of course, you can't. There's no time or no term that's right for abortion, but a woman, I believe, should be able to do with her body with what she wants, and let it be her conscience. Let it be on her conscience as to what has happened. And I think there's more living people. That I think the deal with living should be more accent than the unborn.
Okay. I have a question, just to go back to what you're saying a minute ago, Bill, about you believe a woman should, how did you put it, she should be able to do whatever she wants with her own body?
Well, that, well, I don't mean anything, Patrick. I mean, it's like the woman has to do what the church tells it to do with her body. It's her body. And maybe she's pregnant, carrying a baby from an unwanted sex act or something that she's mm-hmm. not ready for.
Okay. I just want to make sure I understood you. So just to change it a little bit, if the church says, which it does, that, you know, you can't go have sexual intercourse with someone else's husband if you're married or single, the church is telling her what she can and can't do with her body. I mean, is the church wrong for doing that?
The church is, it's still her body, Patrick.
I know that. I know, I'm aware of that, Bill. But what I'm saying is that, do you object to the church pointing out that there are some things you can do with your body that are wrong?
No, Patrick, that's not what I'm saying. That's not what okay. I'm saying at all. Okay. I'm saying that a person that has a body or a woman should conduct herself like a woman should, or like any man or woman should do. Mm-hmm. You know, they should not do un-Catholic or un-religious things with their body.
Okay. So I agree with you on that. So is your objection that you don't like the fact that the church says to somebody, you can't do this with your body? In other words, obviously you can do what you want to do with your body, but you shouldn't do certain things with your body because they're wrong. Is that what you're objecting to?
No, Patrick. I'm objecting to the fact that because Democrats, or we'll say it, Democrats lean more to a person to accepting abortion than the right does. Okay, Republicans or so on, and because of that, when the radio stations, if it's even if it's a religious program, when they talk about the different parties, they'll lean more to the right side than the left side, and I don't think that's right.
Okay, fair enough. Now, how do you feel about slavery, Bill? Just out of curiosity, good, bad, or indifferent?
How do I feel about what, Patrick?
Slavery.
Slavery in any form should be wrong.
Did you know that it was the Democrats who endorsed slavery and fought for it? And it wasn't until a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, who came along and put an end to it with some help from the Union Army. But that was, if we want to talk about abortion as an issue of our generation, that was the issue of that generation. And it split along party lines. Now, it doesn't mean that all Republicans were abolitionists. Many of them were. But it was the Democrats politically who fought to preserve slavery. So how would you have felt? Well, hang on. How would you have felt if we went back in time to, let's say, 1860, and all the Democrats were supporting slavery? Would you be bothered by the church saying, stop it, you guys, slavery is wrong?
No, I wouldn't be bothered with that at all, okay?
Then why would you be bothered with something even worse than slavery, which is killing an innocent person? And the church says, well, that's wrong, you shouldn't do it.
I can't say that. I don't think that slavery should be in this. That killing. Okay, you mentioned. You say killing. Mm-hmm. The fetus. If it's not a born human being yet. The thing about it is, Patrick, is I say more should be done about the living and more emphasis
so you kind
should
of,
be on
you're
the
kind of jumping around here, Bill. You're kind of jumping around, Bill. So you said a minute ago that you didn't like, you said, let's go ahead and say it. Democrats tend to be more in favor of abortion. Okay, I tend to think that that's a true statement. But you started by saying you didn't like the fact that the Catholic Church tells Democrats or whatever that abortion is wrong. But you a minute ago said that you think that slavery is wrong, and you would not have had a problem for the Catholic Church telling the Democrats in the 1860s that they were wrong for endorsing slavery.
I don't see how we're mixing slavery with abortion there, Patrick. I'm saying
I can explain it to you.
Today,
I can explain it to you.
Yes.
Here's how it works, Bill. In other words, we're taking two parallel examples. So slavery, Democrats, the church says slavery is wrong, you shouldn't do it, and it was the Democratic Party in the United States that was supporting and promoting and defending slavery. And you and I both agree that if slavery is wrong, then there's nothing wrong with the church denouncing that and saying, hey, you guys, stop it. Slavery is bad. So abortion is the parallel here because slavery's gone now, but we now have something worse. We have the institutionalized legal killing, and it is indeed killing. That's what an abortion does, of an unborn human life. So if you wouldn't object to the church saying no to slavery and telling Democrats that slavery is wrong, I'm just curious, why aren't you of the same mind when it comes to the church telling Democrats and anyone else for that matter that abortion is wrong?
Hello.
Yeah. How do you answer that question, Bill?
Patrick, the way you're putting it, it's not the reason for my argument.
I'll let you finish, Bill, but I want to say the way I'm putting it is because you can't answer that question. You don't have an answer for the question. And I think that you can see the point that I'm making. That's why you want to get away from this, because you are being inconsistent in defending abortion and denouncing slavery.
Okay.
I'll let you finish, but go ahead.
No, I don't mean to over-talk you or under-talk you or whatever. I'm not trying to compare my knowledge with your knowledge. I'm just saying that when a person when a religious program is talking about something about politics, okay, it always deems the left as being the bad person as to the right, because the right tends to go along with not the no abortion policy. That's all I'm saying. But you went all the way back to slavery and everything. I'm familiar with the Civil War and what the Democrats then wanted. But that was all self. Okay, that was all in the self. You had the abolitionists here that were Democrats, and they. But that's a matter. Yeah. That's a topic for another program. But anyway,
okay, I understand. I understand, Bill. Fair enough. And I don't mean to badger you, but I would respectfully ask you to consider that parallel here, because it is an inconsistency in the way that you're approaching the topic. And I just wanted to point that out. No disrespect to you, Bill. Call anytime. We can be friends. And maybe, who knows, we'll sort through this as time goes on. So call back anytime, Bill. I have to take a break, but I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Get the best premiums and discounts, all without charging fees, through Mission Insurance Solutions, part of the Notre Dame Federal Credit Union family. Go to yourmissioninsurance.com. That's yourmissioninsurance.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Okay, let's see. Where are we going to go now? I'm scanning the phone lines. Let's go to Esmeralda in Sacramento, California. Hi, Esmeralda.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question. I watched His Only Son in the theaters last night about Abraham, and I'm not familiar with the Old Testament, and I wanted to confirm if this was accurate because it's not a, I don't believe it was a Catholic film. Abraham had a child. God told Abraham he would have a child. It sounded like he got impatient, and he had a child with his handmaid, Ishmael, and then his wife, Sarah, got pregnant later with Isaac. So I had two questions. First, did God get mad at Abraham for having a child with his handmaid, or was that okay with God? And then, second, Ishmael, I believe that he sent his son to Egypt, or he sent him off. So did he not want him to be his son anymore?
I can explain,
if he banished them? Thank you.
So Abraham did banish them. So you read about this in Genesis chapters 15 and 16. And in Genesis 16 is where you see that because Sarah, his wife, had had no children, and they were old by then. So she told Abraham, we need a child. We need a son. We need, you know, some children here. So his wife told him to do this, and he obliged her. And so this is where Ishmael was born. He was born from Abraham, from Sarah's servant, Hagar. And so that's where things stood. And I think as you read through Genesis 16, the assumption that Sarah had, Sarai as in those days, was that she would be the lawful mother, even though she wasn't the biological mother. She would raise this child as her own, and she and Abraham would have this child as their child. And because as the three men who visited Abraham prophesied and told her, and this may have been a theophany of the Blessed Trinity, they're depicted here as angels in the form of men. But in any case, they told her, they told Abraham, a year from now, your wife Sarah is going to be pregnant and she's going to have a baby. And she laughed because it was so, in her view, it was so ridiculous that because Abraham was, how old was he? He was into his 80s. And she was also up there in years. So this is why they named the child Isaac, because that's from the Hebrew word for laughter. And it was because she laughed when she heard this. So now they have a situation here because she has her own son with her husband, Abram. And now there's this other kid here, Ishmael, who is not from her. And so this is where we see that Abram, his name hadn't been changed yet, he banishes her. He takes some bread and he takes some water and tells her, you and the child go out in the desert because this isn't going to work. And so he leaves, or she leaves rather. She goes out into the desert. And then there's a miracle that's performed for her and her son so that they don't die. And this is where the Arab race comes from, or at least this is where the Arab culture comes from, the Arab peoples as we know them today. So that's what happened. And now you ask, was God angry with him? I don't think I could say that God was angry with him, because there was no prohibition that was given in those days about having more than one wife. In fact, Jesus talks about this in Matthew chapter 19 when he gets into the question about divorce. That would be sort of serial polygamy. But there was no commandment from God saying that these personages could not have more than one wife. So it wasn't as though Abraham had disobeyed God. It was just an arrangement that God had not said, you can't do this, so he did it. And we can see the problems that arose from that. But God, Jesus typically, when he refers to Abraham, but also St. Paul and elsewhere, they always point back to Abraham as a man of faith and obedience, and how when God told him to do something, even including to kill his own son, he did it. He had faith in God and he was obedient. So that incident with Ishmael and Hagar, as I read it anyway, I don't get the impression that there was any offense against God that God was mad about.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate your response.
You're welcome. Happy to help. And thanks for waiting so long. I know you had to wait a while to get on the air. Thank you. Let's go to Patrick now in Trenton, New Jersey. Good morning, Patrick.
Hi, good morning, Patrick. Okay, from what I understand, dyeing eggs is originally like a pagan kind of tradition. Are we doing anything wrong when we dye eggs like that?
No, not at all. No more than putting a wedding ring on your wife's finger when you get married. Pagans used to do that long before Christianity, but you're not doing it for a pagan reason. In the same way that for the days of the week in English, you know, we have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Those are all derived from pagan divinities. You know, Woden, Thor, etc. The month of March is named after the Roman god Mars, the god of war. Doesn't exist. He's not a real god. But we use days of the week and months of the year and other things that are common that have no pagan connotation, even though pagans used to do those things, or even though they might derive from some pagan origin. It's not pagan for us. Same way with coloring eggs.
Thank you so much, Patrick, for explaining that.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you dropped or if I still had you. Okay. Glad I could help. Let's go now to Sandy in Rhode Island. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning, Patrick. I just have a comment for that that bill that had called regarding the abortion issue.
Yeah.
I'm a retired nurse, and I want to ask him a question. I want to ask him, what is the difference between a person going into a school, creating carnage on children, versus creating carnage with abortion? One instrument uses a gun, the other uses a medical device to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, bottom of the hill, it's death.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
All. That was my statement.
Fair enough. I hear what you're saying, Sandy. Thank you. Appreciate that. How about Gloria now in California? Good morning, Gloria.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I have a dilemma with one of my relatives. She's actually my sister. She's turning 60 years old on Good Friday, and they're going to have a party for her with lots of food and music. And my plan is to fast in the morning and afternoon and have it light dinner at her party. She's really close to me, so I really want to go.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Would it be like a sin or something wrong if I do attend and participate?
No, I don't think it would be a sin. I mean, obviously, it's not ideal, to say the least. Good Friday being a somber commemoration of the sufferings that Jesus went through for our salvation. It's not an appropriate day to have a party like that. But
yes,
if you... Pardon me?
Yes, I understand.
Okay. So with that being the case, my sense of it is that this is a circumstance that you can't help, because it's her birthday. You love her. She's your sister. 60 is a significant milestone, and it just happens to be on Good Friday. So you would not be committing a sin, in my view, if you were to attend this party. But at the same time, you would want to, you know, obviously fast, and abstinence would apply, so no meat at that party. And, you know, in a way, it actually might supercharge the merit in your suffering from abstinence, because if you're abstaining from meat and they've got delicious tacos and who knows what other delicacies might be there, it makes it all the more difficult for you to say no to that, which is good. So there's kind of a spiritual upside for that. But no, I don't think you'd be committing a sin by going under the circumstances. Now, if you were to plan a party when you could have planned it for Saturday or some other day, and you plan it on Good Friday because you just don't care, yeah, I could see where that might be grounds for bringing that to confession, maybe a venial sin perhaps, because it's at the level of inappropriate. It's not.
Yes.
But you're dealing with the circumstances that are beyond your control.
And I did voice my opinion to change it to Sunday instead of Friday. And I did voice my opinion, if we're going to have food, have fish, little things like that. So,
Are these Catholic family members who planned it, or was it your sister who planned it?
Her son actually planned it, and he was raised Catholic, but he's not participating in in the religion. I mean, he does believe in God. He does believe in Jesus, but not a true Catholic.
Yeah, so for him, the Good Friday is like any other day. He doesn't see the importance of it.
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Well, fair enough. As for you, I think if I were in your situation, I would go and I would celebrate, but I would also observe the fast and abstinence, for sure.
Yes, of course. Yes, I will do that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
May she have many happy years yet to come.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gloria. Good chatting with you. We'll go now to Blanca in Dallas, Texas.
Me.
Good morning, Blanca. It's you.
Yeah,
it's
sorry,
you, Blanca.
I'm telling the kids. So great to be on the phone with you.
You.
We have a house full of homeschoolers here in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
and we've been learning a lot about venial and mortal sin, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of questions have come up on how to differentiate and how they get forgiven. So one of my daughters had said that she read in her Seton books that venial sins can be forgiven, like with holy water, doing good deeds, going to the Eucharist, helping your parents, corporal works of mercy, that kind of stuff for venial
mm-hmm.
sins.
Right.
And then we also know that mortal sins are sins that you do conscientiously. You know
mm-hmm.
that they're wrong and you do them anyway.
Right.
So then we're getting really meticulous here in our brains and starting to think like, okay, then where's the line between?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so we were just curious if you could help us
okay,
out.
Okay, sure. I'll read to you what the Catechism of the Catholic Church says on this very topic. It gives a good, clear explanation. So here goes. And I'm going to be reading beginning in paragraph 1852. So just jot this down. You can go back and look at it. There are a great many kinds of sins. Scripture provides several lists of them. The letter to the Galatians contrasts the works of the flesh with the fruit of the Spirit. And that quote goes like this. Now the works of the flesh are plain: fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and the like. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Sins can be distinguished according to their objects, as can every human act, or according to the virtues they oppose by excess or defect. What that means, I'll pause here. What that means is by doing too much of something or not doing enough of something that you should do, or according to the commandments that they violate. They can also be classed according to whether they concern God, neighbor, or oneself. They can be divided into spiritual and carnal sins. And I'll pause here. An example of spiritual sin would be pride. And an example of carnal sins might be, let's say, fornication. Or again, as sins in thought, word, deed, or omission. The root of sin is in the heart of man, in his free will, according to the teaching of the Lord. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, fornication, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a man, Jesus says. But in the heart also resides charity, the source of the good and pure works which sin wounds. Sins are rightly evaluated according to their gravity. The distinction between mortal and venial sin, already evident in Scripture, and it talks about this, it references 1 John chapter 5. The distinction became part of the tradition of the church. It is corroborated by human experience. Mortal sin destroys charity in the heart of man by a grave violation of God's law. It turns man away from God, who is his ultimate end and his beatitude, by preferring an inferior good to him. Venial sin allows charity to subsist, even though it offends and wounds it. Mortal sin, by attacking the vital principle within us, that is charity, necessitates a new initiative of God's mercy and a conversion of heart, which is normally accomplished within the setting of the sacrament of reconciliation. For a sin to be mortal, three conditions together must be met. Mortal sin is sin whose object is grave matter, and which is also committed with full knowledge and deliberate consent. Grave matter is specified by the Ten Commandments, corresponding to the answer of Jesus to the rich young man. Do not kill, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud, honor your father and your mother. the gravity of sins is more or less great. Murder is graver than theft. One must also take into account who is wronged. Violence against parents is in itself graver than violence against a stranger. Just a little bit more. Mortal sin requires full knowledge and complete consent. It presupposes knowledge of the sinful character of the act, of its opposition to God's law. It also implies a consent sufficiently deliberate to be a personal choice. Feigned ignorance and hardness of heart do not diminish, but rather increase, the voluntary character of a sin. Unintentional ignorance can diminish or even remove the imputability of a grave offense, but no one is deemed to be ignorant of the principles of the moral law, which are written in the conscience of every man. The promptings and feelings and passions can also diminish the voluntary and free character of the offense, as can external pressures or pathological disorders. Sin committed through malice by deliberate choice of evil is the gravest. And then lastly, mortal sin is a radical possibility of human freedom, as is love itself. It results in the loss of charity and the privation of sanctifying grace, that is, the state of grace. If it is not redeemed by repentance and God's forgiveness, it causes exclusion from Christ's kingdom and the eternal death of hell. For our freedom has the power to make choices forever, with no turning back. However, although we can judge that an act is in itself a grave offense, we must entrust judgment of persons to the justice and mercy of God. One commits venial sin when, in a less serious matter, he does not observe the standard prescribed by the moral law, or when he disobeys the moral law in a grave matter, but without full knowledge or without complete consent. Now, there's a bit more after that, but that's the essence of how the church describes it in terms of how to know the distinction between mortal and venial sin. And with that, Blanca, I'll have to apologize because I am now past the point where I've got to take a break. I hope that helps, and I appreciate the call. Let's come right back to more of your phone calls right after this.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You may be shy, but don't be too shy to call the Patrick Madrid Show. 888-914. I couldn't resist. Let's go to Lily in Dover, Delaware. Hi, Lily.
Hi, I have a question regarding Scott Hahn's Holy Is His Name Latin video series. Okay. In one of his lessons, he becoming holy, becoming gods. Mm-hmm. He quotes the Catechism 460, and I was fine with the entire lesson and him reading this until the point where he said, for the Son of God became man so that we might become God, and the only begotten Son of God, wanting to make us sharers in his divinity, assumed our nature so that he made man, might make men gods. And I need it explained to me or put into context.
Okay. I can do that.
Because that was jarring to me.
Yeah, if you're not familiar with what that terminology refers to, I could see why it would seem even heretical, but it's not. So what Scott's referring to there is known as theosis, and that's from the Greek word for God, theos. And it means that God divinizes human beings. He doesn't change us into God. That would be impossible because by nature, God is unique. And there can't be more than one God because one God would not be the other God, which would involve a privation or a lack, and that would be impossible for God as God, for there to be any other gods in that sense. So what this refers to, divinization, theosis, however you call it, is that God communicates certain of his attributes. They're called his communicable attributes. Not all of God's attributes are communicable to us as creatures. One principle is that anything that is given can only be received according to the mode of the receiver. So we are, as human beings, the receivers, recipients of those attributes that God can communicate to us, like existence, for example, or beauty, or goodness, and so on. So divinization, simply put, is that God perfects and elevates human nature by his grace and communicates to those who love him these aspects of himself, his holiness, his goodness, etc., so that in heaven we become fully divinized without ceasing to be human beings. We will always be creatures. We will always be human beings. We don't change into angels. We certainly don't change into gods. But we have been maxed out in receiving all of those attributes of God that we can receive. Now, I'll give you an analogy, Lily. This may help. Imagine if you put an iron bar into a furnace. Well, the iron bar eventually receives the attributes of the fire. In other words, it takes into itself the heat, the light, all of those attributes of the fire that can be communicated to it. It receives without ceasing to be an iron bar. Now, obviously, you could heat an iron bar so hot that it would melt and it would cease to be an iron bar, but we're not pushing this analogy too far. That would be a way of thinking about how you receive these attributes of God. And that's what he's referring to. And that's a doctrine of the church, that we become, as we're told in the Bible, that we become like him. St. John says, we don't know what it will be, but we know that we will be like him. And so to that extent, we become divinized.
Helpful? Thank you, because it was very helpful. I thought that's what it might mean, but just reading those words, I thought, no, I need to call Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Thank you. I'm glad I could be helpful on that issue. And it was, and thanks for the call, Lily. It was actually the great St. Athanasius who, in the middle of the third century, he had an aphorism to the effect that God became man so that men could become gods. And he meant it in the sense of theosis. He did not mean that human beings could become God by nature. Important question. Let's go now to Mary Alice in Mobile, Alabama. Hi, Mary Alice.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question. Something you said earlier, I really appreciated your response to the Easter egg question.
Yeah.
And you mentioned wedding rings and days of the week as also being examples of things that we commonly use, but it's not really linked to anything dangerous, right?
Right.
Because Christ makes all things new. And so my question was, does that apply to yoga? I don't really try to exercise mm-hmm. using yoga, because I've heard from a priest before that it is worship stances, and that there's danger that it could be, even though you don't realize what you're doing is a worship stance, it could be dangerous and invocating some type of frightening presence into your life by doing that. So I've never really gone after yoga, but sometimes just in exercising classes, they'll say, all right, now let's stretch, and here's downward dog or child's pose or whatever. And so I'm wondering, you know, is it the same type premise that just like Thursday meant something, it doesn't anymore. If you're not praying while doing yoga or something, it's not the same danger.
Right. So this is a subtle question that you're asking, and I'll do my best to give you a thorough answer in the time I've got. There is a comparison there where you can say that just like the days of the week or the months of the year that were originally named for pagan divinities, we don't use them that way now. We don't mean anything like that when we talk about Thursday, Friday, etc. So yes, there we can say on the yes side of things that yes, that could be understood in the same way that if you're just stretching and you want to become more limber and all of the above, that if it just so happens that you're moving your body in a way that resembles a pose that might be used in yoga as a religious practice or a meditation practice, then that's just happenstance. I mean, you can move your body in any number of different ways, and it doesn't necessarily have to have any meaning to it. So yes, in that sense, it's like the other things. But I would offer this distinction, and think about what would you do if you saw somebody give what you know as the Hitler salute. I don't know if you have children, but if you did have children and they were walking around giving the Hitler salute, What do you think your reaction would be to that if they were doing that?
Oh, I would stop it and make, like, inform them and be like, this is why we don't do this. And
right. That's right. I remember one time I must have been about 8 years old, and some kid came up to me. I was playing in the street in front of our house. Some kid came up to me and pointed the middle finger at me. And I had no clue what that meant. I didn't know what he meant by it. All I knew is that that's kind of weird. And so I asked my parents. I said, well, what does that mean? Because, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with your middle finger. It's not a bad finger. It's just a finger. But what he did had a meaning that I didn't understand. And so my parents explained, and they said, that's why you should never use that finger, at least not to do that. So I think there's some of that involved here as well, where there could be, and for some people there is, a danger because these poses do have meanings in Hinduism. They do have connotations that if you're the 8-year-old Patrick Madrid and you don't know what the middle finger means, you know, you're not doing anything wrong. Or like if a little child points to something using the middle finger, he's not doing anything wrong. He's just using his finger like he would any other finger. But once you become aware of the good one, Cyrus. Did you catch that, Mary Alice? Do you see what he just did there?
I'm sorry, I'm inept. I didn't.
Okay. He was playing some music from a band called Badfinger. So.
Oh, I thought maybe he was using his middle finger to play the piano.
It kind of sounded like that, yeah. So that's what I mean by that. So if a little kid points to something with his middle finger, it's entirely innocent. It doesn't mean anything. He's not doing anything wrong. But we culturally will tell the kids, don't use that finger. Because when you do, other people might think that you mean something that you really don't want to do. And so that's why I think in this issue of yoga, if people become aware, when they become aware that the religious purpose and the meaning of these poses is inherently religious, then there's like a line there, it seems to me, kind of like the Hitler salute or the middle finger. If you know these things have a connotation and other people might see that and think, oh, well, she's practicing meditation or she's into Hinduism, that's, of course, when there would be, I'd say, a line that I wouldn't want to cross. So that's how I look at it. And there is a book. I wish I had it here in studio. I used to have it here, but I don't see it. It's a book by Max Scully, S-C-U-L-L-Y. And it's on Hindu, Reiki, and... I'm sorry, not Hindu. Yoga, Reiki, and there's some third thing. I don't remember now what it was. So he gives an overview of some of these religious connotations of it. You might want to check that book out.
Sure. So it sounds to me like still continue to steer clear of yoga classes, but if when exercising someone says while stretching do this pose, I'll just stretch. I'm not going to and I'll make sure that I inform my own of like try not to do anything that would be considered risky.
I guess maybe. I mean, I feel weird whenever this question comes up, honestly, because I don't want to over-exaggerate, you know, the dangers of yoga. There can be dangers, and I know there's some people who are adamant that you shouldn't practice yoga, and there's even a Catholic version of it called something else. I forget what it's called. But at the same time, going back to those analogies of the Hitler salute or the middle finger, there can be things that, without realizing it, you don't want to do because it has meaning that even if you're unaware of the meaning, it can create problems. And one thing I have noticed is that sometimes people can become so obsessed with yoga that it kind of does become a religion for them. Even if they'd never think about Hinduism per se, it does become a kind of religion for them. I've seen this happen before. So I'm all in favor of being limber and stretching and healthy and all that. That's all good. But don't go down the ideological road.
Sure.
Thanks,
well,
Mary
Alice. I appreciate
Alice.
It. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. Nice chatting with you. And let's do this again tomorrow, shall we? Same Pat time, same Pat channel. And until then, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.